Ms. McGill, at Penn, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's rules or code of conduct? Yes or no?
If the speech turns into conduct, it can be harassment. Yes.
I am asking, specifically calling for the genocide of Jews, does that constitute bullying or harassment?
If it is directed and severe or pervasive, it is harassment.
So the answer is yes.
It is a context-dependent decision, Congresswoman.
It's a context-dependent decision. That's your testimony today. Calling for the genocide of Jews is depending upon the context. That is not bullying or harassment. This is the easiest question to answer. Yes, Ms. McGill.
New York Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik grilling University of Pennsylvania President Elizabeth McGill on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Harvard and MIT's leaders also came under fire for similar prevarication. Meanwhile, Hanukkah begins tonight. You might have seen a big story in the LA Times today about how many people in the country's second largest Jewish community are struggling with the holiday this year. Some are afraid to put up decorations, or maybe they worry a show of faith could be interpreted as steadfast support for Israel amid the war in Gaza. We're going to talk about how Hanukkah hits differently this year with Rabbi Susan Goldberg. She leads the Jewish spiritual community Nefesh. Welcome back to Press Play, Rabbi.
Thank you. Hello, Madeline.
Hi. All right. So what do you make of what we just heard at the top of this, the back and forth on Capitol Hill and the testimonies of these three college presidents? There's been a lot of fallout since then. What's your opinion of what happened there?
Yeah. Well, it was such a contrast with you playing that and then saying, meanwhile, tonight is Hanukkah. It
yeah.
feels very much
I know.
In line.
It's a little whiplash.
What's happening right now? The intensity in the world in so many places. You know, I have a student on a college campus. I have many young people in our community at Nefesh who are on college campuses. And it has been a really hard time to be a Jewish student on a college campus. And I'll just say that part of what is just so stunning about all of it is that college campuses could really be a beacon at this time of showing how we could have discourse on Israel-Palestine. There is such a lack of a meaningful dialogue about what's happening that holds complexity and nuance, that holds compassion, that holds listening and respect and understanding, and holds a clear moral framework mm-hmm. about the awfulness that has happened. And faculty also could be showing up more significantly, but it's hard. It's a scary conversation. It's a difficult conversation, but it is not an impossible conversation. And I know that it's hard. I mean, a lot of what we're doing in our community is really doubling down on dialogue, creating spaces, because one of the things that I think also people don't know is that there's a lot of diversity of lived experiences and opinions and knowledge and even awareness of the fullness of what's happening within the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And so I do a lot of interfaith work. And right now I'm really being called to do a lot of intra-community work.
Oh, that's interesting. So what are the fault lines that you're seeing within the Jewish community? And I guess we'll leave the university discussion to the side right now, because I can see that there's a whole public stance versus a private stance happening there, the need to preserve free speech and a kind of lawyerly response to that question rather than a more human response that, well, genocide and calls for it should be universally condemned. But aside yes. from that, what are you hearing in your community between Jewish people who have differing views?
Yeah, so inside, there's a wide diversity of experience. There are those who are Israeli immigrants or who have family and close friends in Israel, and they have a specific experience that is unique. And I know that a lot of times they're needing to be heard about what, you know, you can imagine how hard it is to be far away when something has happened. We have folks with elderly parents there, with brothers and sisters there, with cousins. We have folks in our community who have cousins who have been held hostage. Two have been released, but there is still two more. There are folks whose family members were killed. And so there's an immediacy to that experience. Mm-hmm. There are others in the community who feel, you know, pretty overwhelmed. So many people are turning to social media right now to get information, which I find very alarming because it is not a good space to get information. And so really trying to encourage people to get quality journalistic reporting as you all are doing and a lot of other sources are doing. And then there was a growing group of Jewish young people in the community and older adults, not just young people, but we see it a lot in younger people who felt that the learning that they did about Israel as kids growing up in the Jewish community really kept the reality and the history of Palestinians was not included. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that was a real failure of Jewish education to not share the full story of what was happening in Israel and Palestine, because I do think that it would allow for a more complete picture now. And, you know, there is a shared humanity and compassion. And really, it is also about the future and having a land of dignity and safety, security, dignity, human rights for everyone. We're going to need to be able to come to a new place in how we approach and learn and talk about what's happening.
Right. So this year's Hanukkah, which is a celebration of faith and a miracle that the oil lasted 8 nights, but it's also a celebration of a military victory by a much less powerful group of warriors against a more heavily armed state, I guess. So how are you looking at Hanukkah differently this year?
One of the things that I've heard from people is a growing sense of fear in being a Jew in the United States. I mean, there are the issues we're talking about Israel and Palestine, which I say a lot to our community. You know, we can learn and we can do our best to support humanitarian efforts and to learn, but really it's Israelis and Palestinians that are going to be taking the lead in that. We really need to be able to support them because we do have agency here as Americans living in a climate that is getting more and more polarized. You know, we saw the beginning of the rise of this next wave of anti-Semitism started around the 2016 elections, around conspiracy theories and things happening. And so it's in that setting that this now is getting even worse. And so there is a lot of fear. There is growing fear. You know, should I take down my mezuzah in my house? Is it okay to wear a Star of David necklace? There have been anti-Semitic incidents. You know, the temple nearby us in another neighborhood in Burbank was, you know, had vandalism, and there have been several things happening. And so I know that is part of what's happening. And it feels really important this year that Hanukkah is a time to come forward with our Jewish identity, even when it feels scary and difficult, because part of the mitzvah of Hanukkah is that we publicize it, that we put our menorahs in the window, that we say, this is who we are, and we're here in the community. And the other really important part, because, you know, we are such a very, very small minority. I think people forget that. We are a tiny minority, the Jewish community. And so what it really is that we need this year is we're needing for folks who are not Jewish to also express connection, concern, solidarity, to say, hey, you know, how can I help to make this workplace, this neighborhood, our community, a place that you feel safe and comfortable, and happy Hanukkah. It's at the minimum. I see you. I know that you're here. And I want you to know that I'm working to make our neighborhood, our workplace, our school, our community, a place that affirms who you are as a Jewish person and makes it safe for you. It feels like this Hanukkah, it's important for Jewish people to feel connected to who we are in all of our diversity. And I also think it's really important that non-Jewish people take an opportunity to express that we are seen and affirmed during this time.
Well, happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
Rabbi Susan Goldberg leads the Jewish spiritual community Nefesh right here in Los Angeles. and happy first day of our end of year fundraiser. You're listening to the Season of Giving Back. It is really an excellent time to give back when we're feeling the need to try to make some positive contribution in this troubling world. At the time, it is full of strife. Maybe it's always full of strife, but it feels especially bad these days. But we are here to bring you a ray of light during this holiday season. Really, during the whole year, we bring you rays, many rays of light. And so we count on you to give back when the time is right. And now is that time because we have a KCRW champion named Mark Sandelson who will match your gift up to $10,000 today. So if you give today, your dollar will be worth $2 and on. So go to kcrw.com/give and do it now. You can also get a tax contribution, a tax deduction there by contributing to us at kcrw.com/give. Coming up, when you have an iPhone, your text bubble is blue. If you don't, it's green. And, well, because we humans are petty, there is judgment. It is seeped into dating. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you're an iPhone user, admit it. When you get a text message and the bubble's green and not blue, you kind of judge that person a little bit on the other end, don't you? Like, oh, they don't have an iPhone. They have like a Samsung or a Google Pixel. Well, there are actual security and technical reasons for that bubble imbalance that go well beyond simply Apple versus Android. Apple will make changes early next year to improve texting technology. But according to my next guest, now it's our turn to end bubble shaming. Brian X. Chen is the lead consumer technology writer for the New York Times and author of their column Tech Fix. Welcome back to Press Play, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So as we prepared for this conversation, my producer who has an iPhone texted you and the bubble was blue. So phew. But I'm wondering,
what a relief.
Do you what a relief. A fellow traveler. But do you privately or maybe publicly judge the green bubblers?
So look, I'll admit, I along with plenty of adults have snickered about this issue. I do have friends who have Android phones, and when we have group chats, like say discussing Thanksgiving dinner or something years ago, if the whole group chat turned green, then that would annoy us because things like photos and videos didn't look good anymore. Or if we wanted to leave the group conversation, we couldn't because that feature didn't work. So it's definitely annoying, and it's something that we all laugh about, but when you think about it more deeply, there's some issues with that way of thinking.
Okay, well, first of all, let's get at that way of thinking, because what is it? Do iPhone users think they're superior because they have an iPhone?
Well, let me put it this way. I think the way that people in the United States think about it is that people in the in-group are the iPhone people because the iPhone, it dominates the United States. It's about 60% iPhones, 40% Android phones in the US. So if you have a blue bubble, you're in the in-group. If you have a green bubble, you're in the out-group. So those who are inside that comfortable blue bubble, they get kind of annoyed when some people in that so-called out-group, you know, they come in and they taint the group chat and they make all these features break. That's something that has created a split among people using different types of devices. It gets kind of harmful when we think about schools. A lot of kids in school, they're getting their first smartphones, and a lot of them are getting iPhones. But if you have an Android, then you're suddenly in that out-group. The iPhone users who are the blue bubbles don't want you ruining things like the group chats they're having over homework. They're making plans to get together at the mall, right? And they don't want the Androids to ruin that bubble, so they leave them out of the conversation, which, as you can imagine, can be pretty harmful to a kid's well-being and their ability to study and issues like that. So we laugh about these issues, but they can be more serious when you think about it more deeply.
Right. So there, it could be some form of bullying
Yeah, some people would consider that cyberbullying.
But why don't they have the same abilities? Like, why do the green bubblers not work well with the blue bubblers?
So historically, for many years, more than a decade, the default texting standard that all cell phones have used have been SMS and MMS. And those sent really blurry, crummy-looking photos, to be honest. So Apple, they've made their own proprietary messaging system called iMessage. This came out roughly a dozen years ago. And people inside that blue bubble, which is iMessage, have been able to send high-resolution photos and videos to each other, among other features. And then years later, Google came up with their own standard, or they adopted a modern standard called RCS, which is Rich Communication Services, where you could send high-resolution images between Android users. But those two technologies never got along, what Apple was doing of iMessage versus what Google was doing of RCS. So next year, Apple is adopting RCS. They're going to start integrating RCS into, or actually alongside iMessage. So there's going to continue to be green bubbles, but the images and videos are going to look better when you're talking to Android people.
Will you be able to exchange emojis?
To an extent. So you have different looking emojis on iMessage, and you have some slightly different ones on Android. So you make a good point that technologically the divide is not totally closed. And there's still going to be features missing, like the ability to, say, you know, send these animations with the confetti for your birthday. That only works in iMessage. It's not going to work in Android. So there's going to continue to be a divide in terms of the technology. But the most important part for now are these images and videos. It's really what's ruining people's communication methods when it comes to cross-platform messaging. So that's going to be a significant step toward improving the situation. But I think it's really the rest of it is on us to drop it with some of these deeper issues like cyberbullying, for example.
Mm-hmm. What if we just all decamp to WhatsApp? Then we would all be on the same platform.
Yeah. There have been solutions like that for many, many years. And yet this divide happened anyway, because so many of us use the default texting apps for text messaging. But yes, third-party messaging apps like Signal and WhatsApp, they offer a lot of those features that iMessage offers, and they work consistently between Android and iPhone. So you can do things like group chats, you can leave a group chat, you have encryption, you have some fun stickers, emojis, and so on. That solution has always been there, but most of us have stuck with the defaults and not wanted to include each other, and instead had these this broken messaging system that didn't really work well between Androids and iPhones, that created this simmering tension between the green bubbles and the blue bubbles.
Oh my God, sounds like the Capulet.
Yeah.
It sounds like Shakespearean.
That's a good analogy for sure.
Is it really that bad? I hadn't really noticed it, to be honest.
I mean, you'll probably have casual conversations where we're all joking about it, like the adults that have iPhones get bothered. We're just slightly annoyed, and that's something that you joke about, right? Like when someone ruins your blue bubble and turns it green, it's not really a big deal. But when you look around and see how other people are treating this incompatibility between messaging platforms, it's creating other big problems. Like you go into the dating app world, and I haven't been on a dating app for a while, but as you can imagine, like when you're in a dating app, you message each other inside the dating app, but when you decide you're going to meet in person, you move on to the text messaging app. And once that bubble turns green, it's been kind of a thing that people say that it's a red flag.
Really?
Yeah, this is like, if you read, like you can Google this, like there are essays that people have written, is this person cheap? Does this person have his stuff together, you know? They don't like it when it turns green. And that's like a stigma that's been created by this frustration between the blue bubbles and the green bubbles. And it also stems from this stereotype that Android users don't have very much money. Mm. And that stereotype comes from some truth, which is that, you know, plenty of Android phones are pretty affordable. Like the fact that so many different manufacturers make Android phones makes them more affordable. The price range is somewhere between $100 all the way up to $1,200. So like, plenty of people buy these really expensive Android phones, and therefore a phone is not a reflection of your income. So the fact that some people are judging each other in the dating world based on the color of the bubble, and they're sometimes not going on these dates because the bubble turns green.
Oh my God. Well, if you're that superficial, then there's no
yeah.
hope for you.
And I guess what I'm getting at with this column is, like, when we're ghosting people in dating apps over a green bubble, it's kind of a form of elitism. And not only are we shaming other people for the technology that they use, which is judgmental, but we're depriving ourselves potentially of meeting people who might turn out to be pretty awesome.
Brian X. Chen, lead consumer technology writer for the New York Times and author of their Tech Fix column. Brian, thank you.
Hey, thanks again.
Hey, guess what? This is the first day of our end of the year fundraiser, KCRW's Season of Giving Back. An excellent time to make a tax-deductible donation. So if you're thinking of where you're giving your dollars at the end of the year for that tax deduction and also for feeling good about contributing to the broader world, think of us at KCRW. Think of the place where you get the news, the information, the music, the culture, all the cultural events that you love every single day of the year. And let's face it, it's free, really. When you turn on the radio or fire up your app or whatever it is you're listening on, you don't have to pay because others have done it for you. But we would like you to pay just a little bit if you can. KCRW.com/join. And tons of great thank you gifts and also great gift ideas there on the website. So check it out there. Coming up on the program, we will have your weekend movie reviews.
I'm just going to go out there and I'm not going to bury the lead. I'm going to tell you it's my favorite movie of the year.
Favorite movie of the year. We're going to tell you what that is next on Press Play. You're listening to KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand with this week's film reviews, and they are doozies. There is a movie based on a musical, which is based on a movie adapted from a book that's about the writing of the book, plus a couple of dead people who aren't really dead, thanks to a mad scientist and a talking bird. With me to discuss are film critics Christy Lemire and Alonzo Duraldi. They both co-host the YouTube channel Breakfast All Day. Hello, you two.
Hello.
Hello.
All right. Let's talk about The Dead or the Not Dead, the movie Poor Things, starring Emma Stone, Willem Dafoe, Mark Ruffalo, and Rami Youssef.
I find myself merely jealous of the men's time with you, rather than any moral aspersion against you. It is your body, Bella Baxter, yours to give freely.
I generally charge 30 francs.
Well, that seems low.
Okay, Christy, this is about a woman who is brought back from the dead by a mad scientist. It's set in Victorian England. And it is Emma Stone there and director Yorgos Lanthimos reunited because they were together for that movie, The Favourite. What did you think of this one?
I love this movie so much. I'm just going to go out there and I'm not going to bury the lead. I'm going to tell you it's my favorite movie of the year.
Ooh.
It is astonishing. If you think you even know what this is based on the trailers, I promise you, you don't. There is so much more going on here. And it is so wild and outlandish and surprising and beautiful over and over again. But yes, you mentioned Emma Stone there reuniting with Yorgos Lanthimos. And this has a lot of the sort of the core stuff that Yorgos Lanthimos does so singularly, which is there's like a breach of decorum within genteel settings, right? There's a way people should behave and they don't. And there's a beautiful, awkward humor in all of that over and over again. But then here you have Emma Stone as a woman on a journey of exploration. She has been protected and controlled throughout her life. And as she travels from place to place and evolves as a person, she comes fully into her own and it's just thrilling. The costume design, the production design, and all of it, the score, it all works together so beautifully. Tony McNamara wrote the script here. It's based on Alistair Gray's novel. Mm-hmm. And there's not the biting meanness that you see in The Favourite, which Tony McNamara also wrote for Yorgos Lanthimos, but there's like an oddity and like a pleasing kind of odd rhythm of like the poetry of the language. I just loved it. And Emma Stone's incredible here.
Well, Tony McNamara also created the Hulu show The Great, which has a similar vibe to it from what I can tell. Alonzo?
Well, you know, it's similar to The Great in terms of its kind of absurdist humor and the notion of a woman coming into her own strength and power and understanding of herself. Mm-hmm. But it is way off the map of where The Great goes. Yeah, this is a movie that is grotesque and madcap, but at the same time, deeply human and moving and really sort of rooted in a woman's journey through her life and of self-discovery. It's also my favorite movie of this year. You know, it is just visually a treat and plays around with what would and wouldn't be found in that era. You know, it butts up against steampunk without, you know, digging too far into that. It, you know, has a sense that anything is possible, but at the same time has real stakes to it. It's just extraordinary.
Just extraordinary. Okay. Wow. I'm blown away by your enthusiasm. I'm so excited to see this. Poor Things is in theaters beginning tonight. Next up, an animated film by Japanese filmmaker Hayao Miyazaki. It's called The Boy and the Heron. The boy's mother is dead, but the heron says otherwise.
A lot of strange things happen in this place.
I just hope he stays safe.
Save me.
Save me, Maito!
What exactly are you?
Your mother. She's awaiting your rescue. I'll be your guide.
All right, Alonzo. I thought Miyazaki was all done making movies, but I guess he came out of retirement and chain smoked his way through making another one. So tell us more about this one.
Yeah, when Miyazaki says he's done, it's like Cher announcing a farewell tour. It's like, until the next one, that is. Yeah, this is, you know, describing the plot of a Miyazaki film under the best circumstances is generally like trying to recount what happened to you in a dream. And this is probably one of his least easily followed narrative, but it still makes a sense if you just go with it. If you just roll with it, it involves parallel universes. It involves a young person on a journey of discovery and of maturity. So it really fits in with a lot of films like Spirited Away, certainly. It has the kind of otherworldliness and the anthropomorphic animals of something like Princess Mononoke. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it operates under such a sense of dream logic and spirituality that it's almost like watching a Pichapong Virasethakun movie. That said, it is hauntingly beautiful. His films are always just like watching a series of beautiful paintings. I could watch a bicycle go down a country path in a Miyazaki movie and mm-hmm. just take in all the detail. But this is, you know, about a young man during the World War II era, kind of dealing with family trauma, dealing with, you know, sort of a national crisis. Weirdly, I saw this back to back with Godzilla Minus One, which also deals with Japan and World War II and their sort of collective trauma. But yeah, this is another masterpiece from our greatest living animator.
I love everything that he does. Christy, what about you? Did you love this one, The Boy and the Heron?
I did. And there actually might be too much stuff going on here. There might be too many ideas and too many weird creatures. Like, it's almost overwhelming and you can't take it all in. Like, we were talking about Poor Things is kind of overwhelming. I mean, this for sure is too. It's visually sumptuous. I mean, from the very beginning, there's such delicate artistry to Miyazaki's work. All the hand-drawn animation is so rare these days. But there's also, you know, horrific imagery, as we often see. That's really terrifying. I mean, early on, there's this catastrophic fire that occurs, and there's like a warmth, like you can feel the heat through the flames. There's like a smudgy kind of abstract quality to the oranges and the reds that really put you in there. And it's gorgeous, but also terrifying at the same time. You have the super cute, adorable little creatures that you get in a Miyazaki movie, but you also have like really frightening predatory parakeets. Like,
And you're not even in Pasadena.
Right. It'd be perfect. Yes. But it's like, they're beautiful, but like the creatures evolve in ways that it's almost nightmarish. I understand that this has some semi-autobiographical qualities for Miyazaki, which makes it feel even more personal. But yeah, it's just a total delight. I mean, there's stuff with like fish and frogs that will give you nightmares, but then there's also a great deal of catharsis and healing by the end. So it's quite lovely.
Excellent. The Boy and the Heron in a few theaters right now, and it goes wider starting tomorrow. Next up, Origin, a film from director Ava DuVernay, adapted from and literally about the writing of the book Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson.
All over the place. There's connective tissue. All of this. All of it. Is linked.
Okay, Christy, this isn't exactly a documentary. The actress Ingenue Ellis-Taylor plays the author Isabel Wilkerson as she's writing this book. It also stars Niecy Nash and John Bernthal. What did you think?
It's complicated, this movie. You mentioned that it's not a documentary. I almost wish that it had been, because it feels like two different movies kind of slammed against each other in a really clunky way. Because you have Ingenue Ellis-Taylor playing Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, as she is writing this book, as she's researching this book, but then also undergoing tremendous personal loss, personal tragedy, and that helps fuel her and drive her in this mission. And I feel like it needed to be one or the other, because the way she has constructed this ends up feeling really unwieldy and ultimately didactic. Like the points that she's making in her research in ultimately what would be this book are about how it's not about racism per se. It's about how, you know, it's the caste system and some people keeping others down, whether it is the Holocaust or it is slavery or it's the caste system in India. And Ingenue Ellis-Taylor as Isabel Wilkerson gives a lot of speeches and goes to all these places and talks to actual people and does, there's a lot of her like in libraries, there's a lot of her like reading books and writing things down and typing things in her laptop. And that is not nearly as interesting as when she and Niecy Nash as her cousin, who's more like a sister, get together and really talk about things. You know, there are some great moments with Ingenue Ellis and John Bernthal in an uncharacteristically kind of sweet and mild and nerdy role kind of as her husband. And they have some lovely times together. But then Ava DuVernay also tries to recreate moments from history, whether it's a couple dancing in 1940s Germany or a young African-American boy not being allowed to swim in a pool in 1950s America. It's just too much, and it really doesn't work ultimately. It's a rare misfire for her.
Oh, wow. Alonzo, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree. This has, unfortunately, it's neither fish nor fowl. And we've seen DuVernay, you know, 13 is an incredibly powerful documentary. We've also seen her dramatize, you know, historical incidents in Selma and When They See Us. And I will even go to bat for her adaptation of the novel A Wrinkle in Time, which I think was at least, you know, ambitious, and a lot of it works. But yeah, I think here, if she had picked either going full on dramatization or full on documentary, she could have come up with something. And there are certainly moments here that are going to stay with me. There's one scene with Audra McDonald that is incredibly powerful. The segment that Chrissy talked about with the child in the swimming pool has a brutal power to it. And those moments kind of make you realize how much of the rest of the movie just isn't quite working.
All right, Origin in limited release tomorrow and nationwide January 19th. Finally, a performance recording of the Broadway musical Waitress with songs from Sara Bareilles, and it stars her too.
Sugar, butter, flour, sugar.
Order up!
Gonna bake themselves.
Jenna.
Life's just peachy, peachy, king pie.
Jenna.
Where there's a whisk, there's a way pie.
Okay, Alonzo, this is a musical version of an indie film from back in 2007 called Waitress. So this is a recording of the stage musical? Is that what it is?
Yes. The Broadway show actually came back briefly in 2021, mainly so that they could record it with Sarah Bareilles, who did the songs and has played the lead at certain points in the show's existence, to record that for posterity. And I'm so thrilled that they did, because I've never gotten to see this show on stage, but it absolutely pops here. And it is, the 2007 movie is great, and it was the final film from the brilliant Adrian Shelley, who died tragically before it was released. But this really, the story still holds up. It's about a woman who is trapped in an abusive marriage and gets pregnant and is just trying to figure out how to get away from her husband, how to get on with her life. And she expresses herself through the pies that she makes at this diner, which is her connection to her mother. And, you know, not all movies loan themselves, I think, to being musicals. And we've seen so many efforts at that in the last couple of decades. But this one, absolutely, if you were to approach this material for the first time, you wouldn't know that it wasn't always a musical. It's all very organic. The cast here is really terrific. Sarah Bareilles is heartbreaking, and the songs that she does are so beautiful. Drew Gehling as her OBGYN that she winds up having an affair with, has a wonderfully sort of gawky presence, but also very heartfelt and romantic. Dakin Matthews as the crusty owner of the diner, who, you know, Sarah Bareilles' character can sort of see his softer side. And I think that as opposed to a lot of other filmed musicals, there really are some cinematic choices here. Like, you see occasional slow-mo even in certain moments where like pies are being made or whatever, which is not something you usually get when someone is filming a Broadway show. So this is all very well done.
Christy, well done.
Yeah, I was impressed too. And there's a real clever way with the staging in terms of people coming in and handing a person a prop or taking a person's jacket off or moving a couch to make way for the next set. So you feel like you're right in the middle of it all. But then when it breaks from that, after her signature song, She Used to Be Mine, the camera is at the back of the stage and you see her silhouetted in the spotlight and you see the whole crowd come to its feet because this is like her big moment. And that is so striking in the way it deviates from everything else. The cast is great. Yeah. Also, I liked Christopher Fitzgerald as the kind of dorky suitor, yes, for the dorky waitress who is the Adrian Shelley character in the original film. Everyone's really, really good in this. I'm glad I saw it.
Wow. Okay. We have some good ones this week. Waitress in limited release beginning today. Christy Lemire, Alonzo Duralde co-host the YouTube channel Breakfast All Day. So go check that out if you want an even longer and more in-depth and, dare I say, even more animated conversation about movies. Thank you both. Have a great weekend.
You Thank too. You. Thanks.
All right. You tune in every day to KCRW in some form or another. Maybe Press Play is your lunchtime companion. Thank you for spending your year with KCRW and for your support. If you are able, we would like you to toss in an extra special donation, an extra special token of your love and appreciation to keep us in your life at kcrw.com/give. I'm just looking over a few recent highlights of our show. Yesterday, we remembered Norman Lear in a fantastic conversation with two really insightful and sensitive critics. We also had that funny analysis of the word of the year, Riz. Of course, we always have our legal analysis with our superb legal Jessica Levinson. Lots of things. Oh, and our music. We have a music segment every week. We did something on Miles Davis. We've done the Wu-Tang Clan. We've done classical music, hip-hop. We do it all here at KCRW. If that's something that you appreciate, we would like you to return the favor at kcrw.com/give. Lots of great end of the year thank you gifts there for you to check out, and lots of actual gifts that you might want to give during this giving season. kcrw.com/give. That is the place to go. Thank you so much for giving a little extra to your favorite radio station. Coming up on Press Play, sick of cooking already this holiday season? Evan Kleinman is here with some takeout ideas, and that is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes Bake Off Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Thanksgiving is behind us. The holiday season is in full swing. And if you feel burnt out on baking or overcooked on cooking, you are not alone. Have no fear. Evan Kleinman is here with some ideas for takeout. She hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi.
So we can order this food any day, not just for the holidays, right?
Yeah, but what I was thinking was, you know, during the holidays, there are often gatherings to like wrap presents or just hang out. And I don't think we should expect ourselves to cook all the time.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot. And yeah. I also think that sometimes it's fun to order takeout that is different than what you might normally do for your family or mm-hmm. friends.
Okay, and, well, let's begin with Hanukkah because it runs through December 14th. And why not order in?
Absolutely. And what I think is really interesting is, you know, maybe you want to make your own latkes, but you want help with the rest of the meal, or you want someone to do the whole thing for you one of the nights. But I have to say that barbecue brisket is pretty perfect for Hanukkah. And Slab Barbecue is making the entire meal, including the latkes with fixings. But if you want to make your own latkes, just get the brisket from them. I think we forget sometimes that brisket is also this amazing barbecue food. Of course, Akash in Culver City, she's become a go-to for many over the holiday. Her menu for Hanukkah is huge and a la carte. So you can make some stuff if you want, bring other items in, or you can just look through her whole menu and pick and choose what you want. In addition to brisket, she offers a Moroccan roast chicken, latkes, of course, noodle kugel, and more. If you're eating a plant-based diet, you can try Mort and Betty's, which is a vegan pop-up. They make vegan latkes in the classic mode and also a very popular dill pickle variation. Also, not to be missed, their challah shaped like a menorah, which is adorable.
Wait, can I just rewind for a second? A dill pickle latke? Is that what you said?
Yeah, so they're latkes with, you know, grated dill pickles in it, which I think is really smart.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then one of my favorite brisket adjacent foods in town is the galbijjim from Sunnongdong in Koreatown. It's an insanely delicious short rib stew with potatoes and carrots and rice cakes. And I would be very happy to have that to go with my latkes.
I would be very happy to have that to go right this minute.
Yes. So, anytime.
Anytime. Anytime.
It is such a happiness-making food.
Okay, well, so are tamales, but Christmas is tamale time. So let's say it's not part of your family's traditional repertoire, but you want to eat them anyway. Where do we get them?
So, you know, there are so many lists. I just have chosen three that I've had that I know are good. La Indiana, I love La Indiana. Tiny little place, but a classic here in town. They offer all the traditional tamales you may expect with chicken, with beef. They make fresh corn. They make a really great rajas and cheese. And if you're lucky, sometimes the rajas are made with red ripe jalapenos. And of course, they also have the sweet tamales for the holidays. Loteria Grill is bringing back some longtime tamal favorites wrapped in corn husks. And they're adding a couple new ones, a cochinita pibil tamal made in a banana leaf, and also a black bean and hoja santa tamal cooked in banana leaf, which sounds really intriguing to me.
What's hoja santa?
Hoja santa is a large leaf that is lightly scented of anise. It's a wonderful herb. And then if you're interested in vegan tamales, Mama's International Tamales at MacArthur Park is a really good bet here in the city.
So you would need to order these ahead of time.
Yeah, for Loteria, you need to definitely order ahead. For La Indiana and Mama's, you can go anytime you want and pick them up. But I think as we get closer to Christmas, the smarter it is to order. And I would say that is true of all of the suggestions on this list. places like Slab and Akasha will probably sell out at some point. So it's a good idea to order. With tamales, you can actually pick them up ahead and freeze them. Some tamalerias sell them already frozen. And then all you have to do is steam them the day of.
Mm. All right. Another Christmas tradition for a lot of people is Chinese food. So what are your favorite spots?
Yeah. Genghis Khan on Fairfax serves around 1,000 people in-house between Christmas Eve and Christmas, but they also do to-go. So that is really a great go-to. Yang Chow in Chinatown, Pasadena, and Long Beach are known for their slippery shrimp. I would sign up for that. But if you're thinking of ordering on the day, definitely order ahead and maybe be prepared to wait a bit on Christmas Day.
All right. Any honorable mentions for holiday parties or get-togethers we didn't get to?
Well, I think Angelini Osteria is really a great place to create your own Italian feast. You can order a la carte from the regular menu, but they also have kind of larger formats, sort of light catering amounts. So you could order a whole porchetta. Porchetta is the famed whole pork loin. Sometimes it's a whole pig, but often here it's served as a whole pork loin that is slathered with fennel, rosemary. I think their menu is really beautifully suited to a festive Italian meal to go.
And panettone, of course. Okay, and what else?
Well, you know, I'm always ready to fall into a vat of Mexican food. And often if I have friends coming over, I'll go to Cinco Puntos in East LA. It's a really complete Mexican deli experience. They're a carnitas specialist. You can watch them making it in these giant copper vats. But they have everything you need. Beans, rice, salsa, guacamole, freshly made tortillas, as well as their own tamales. They do trays of enchiladas. If you're going earlier than Christmas Eve, you could just go and pick out what you want. You can call, or you could go ahead and order and then pick up.
All right. We will have the complete list up at kcrw.com. Evan Kleinman hosts KCRW's Good Food, which you can listen to Saturday mornings at 10. Subscribe to the podcast and Evan's newsletter at kcrw.com/goodfood. It's free. Evan, what is on your show this week?
I have a really great conversation with Nancy Silverton on the occasion of her new cookie book, which is such a fun book. And we just really enjoy talking to each other. So I think the conversation will be really fun for people to listen to. Also, a young food writer named James Park wrote a really quirky book about chili crisp, not only about it, but how to make your own kinds. And I think that's a really fun thing to do for gifting at Christmas. We talked to a couple who help you figure out how to make your own vanilla extract. And at the farmer's market, we're going to turn our focus on florals for a change.
Do you think it's worth it to make your own vanilla extract?
I think it's something really fun to do. I have a quart of DIY vanilla extract that started at Angeli 25 years ago.
So it doesn't go bad?
No, just gets better and better, better. We used to take all of our spent vanilla pods that we would scrape out for baked goods and put them in a jar, and then I filled it up with rum, and it's just amazing.
I would drink that in a previous life, but anyway.
It's great in cocktails. It's great as a tiny little addition to cocktails.
Yum. All right. Evan Kleinman, always with the ideas. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Always with the ideas. If you have gotten one fabulous food idea from Evan Kleinman this entire year, then now's the time to go to kcrw.com/give and give a little bit back as a thank you. Just one that saved you time, money, that delighted you. And that's just one tiny little thing. It's not so tiny, but it's just one data point in a vast sky of data points here at KCRW. If we have delighted you, if you've learned something, if you've been keyed into a really cool new musical act, musical group, if you've gone to an art happening or a concert or anything because you've heard it on KCRW, now's the time to think about how KCRW adds value to your life and give a little bit back at the end of the year. This is our Season of Giving Back fundraiser. This is day one, and we're looking to start with a great showing from you, and there is a challenge grant, so your dollar is worth $2. You'll be donating twice as much if you donate now at kcrw.com/give. Do it now and just thank you. Feel good about it and make us feel good too. kcrw.com/give. That does it for this week on our program. Our producers are Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser. Michelle Aloy is our hardworking line editor. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer. And our technical director is the ever super Mario Saavedra. Also, Sue Margulies engineered this week. All these people are working for you. Donate, kcrw.com/give. I'll see you on Monday.